If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
Thank you so much for staying with us. So last week we promised you a conversation on what is happening in Gaza and obviously the conversations that Israel and the US are having in relation to Gaza. And we couldn't do that because there were other matters that needed to be taken care of. So we asked our director of research at Orwell Social Economic Research Institute to join us. And he very graciously agreed to speak to us today, Angela Fick. Thank you so much for being with us this evening. Good evening.
Yes, good evening to you, to the listeners.
So, obviously, over the weekend, Secretary of State met with Netanyahu to discuss Gaza. They seem to be on the same page. Do you think they will carry this plan through?
Well, one doesn't know, given the back and forth in the Trump administration and given the internal issues happening in the state of Israel around Mr. Netanyahu, that one imagines that they will begin to implement this. And those people who have been trying to broker a ceasefire, a peace deal, will realize that all sorts of issues about the state of Israel's responses that have been alerted as early as, just after the October 7th events, which is now almost 2 years ago, will suddenly, will have to be borne in mind. But this is, of course, not, Mr. Trump is not the first to suggest this, nor is this the first time the United States has this policy of the depopulation of the historical Palestine of actual Palestinians. This has been a position that has long been held in the U.S. establishment. A solution would be for the Palestinians to merely disappear from the territory that they currently claim, and that would be an end to that kind of tension for them.
So one would argue that actually, as you're pointing out, these are discussions that they've been having perhaps in, private rooms. Trump is the one who's been brave enough to openly say, well, this is exactly what our plan is and we're going to carry it out.
Yes, or to propose that this is what he thinks the plan is going to be. So the official response by the United States to the Nakba of 1948, particularly around various United Nations Security Council resolutions against the state of Israel, has always been consistent since the 1960s. And so this idea of the right to return is now finally going to be removed and no longer become an issue that the United States has to equivocate about. How this will impact on its relations with allies that it currently has in the Middle East other than Israel remains to be seen, because we know that this is not the position of the Saudis, this is not the position of Egypt, this was not the position the King of Jordan has indicated, because his state was originally one of the sites to which the refugees of the 1948 and even of later excursions and removal of the Palestinians from land in historical Palestine is where they ended up, in places like Jordan. So he may be very unhappy with what is about to happen in his state if the proposal is that people must be removed there.
So do you think some of these Arab states that you've just mentioned in the end will have to buckle whether they like it or not?
We don't know. We know that Saudi Arabia is a very powerful sort of center around the oil industry and particularly around the world energy demand. And whether or not the Saudis play along with this, we don't know. We know that there is a proposal that a peace deal else in the world be negotiated in Saudi Arabia, so that's the Russia-Ukraine issue. But we need to bear in mind that Mr. Trump and his administration have had various attempts changing not only the global order, but also the internal United States order, and they've not always been equally successful. So Mr. Trump's proposal that Greenland, for example, that becomes part of the United States, was heavily objected to by its current owner, so to call it in that sense, Denmark, and this is a NATO ally of the United States. So there are internal dynamics changing inside NATO. How they respond is going to be interesting. Mr. Trump's response to his immediate neighbors around issues of trade has had to be scaled back on. So this may also be one of those initial responses that Mr. Trump and his administration give, which they may have to climb back down from, because it turns out that several of their allies are not in agreement with this. And we know that the European Union may have very different ideas about how to resolve this, because they're actually close to the region, and whatever fallout there is likely to hit then, long before it hit the continent of the United States.
He's obviously appealing a lot to his constituency within the U.S., very conservative, a right wing. But you've just mentioned, you know, some of the examples of how there is pushback. So not everybody is lying back and saying, okay, go ahead and do what you will. And also the judiciary in the U.S. are also doing their bit to push back on some of those executive orders. How do you think he's likely to respond to all this pushback?
One imagines that he's not going to be happy with it because his response has been to simply up the rhetoric. So in one of his latest communications, he indicated that a quite inflammatory statement made in public, in print, was that the people who defend their country are not criminals, which, of course, empowers all sorts of people in ways that he may not necessarily, or those who support this may not necessarily foresee. Some of the first people who are not likely to benefit from some of the local domestic cutbacks that Mr. Trump has made through Elon Musk's DOG, Department of Government Efficiency, has affected a whole lot of people who depend, and they have voted for Mr. Trump, but depend on very specific state structures that have now been dismantled. So, for example, dismantling the health sector that responds to pandemics, responds to diseases, withdrawing the United States from the World Health Organization, scaling back on compulsory vaccination in the education system, is likely to begin to affect poorer Americans much more quickly. And so all of those very specific poorer Americans who voted for Mr. Trump may now find out that that's not necessarily what they voted for. And we've already heard, for example, from some farmers that their understanding of why they supported Trump is, of course, not what they're getting from him. And so one farmer has even been quoted to say, it may be hard to admit that you're wrong, but it's not hard to admit that you've been lied to. So I think there is likely to be a very different swing, in the United States domestic politics around this. Should Mr. Trump begin with Mr. Netanyahu to implement this? Mr. Netanyahu has his own domestic problems in the state of Israel because of a powerful client population, both ahead of the October 7 attacks and throughout his campaign in Gaza and that of his government and military. And so one imagines that these are leaders who feel particularly strong in this moment, but the conditions under which they govern are so volatile that things could very easily turn on them very quickly. And if not all cards line up in the way that they imagine, they could sit with a very different kind of scenario. And Mr. Trump is quite happy to reverse decisions that he's made, even when they betray very specific allies, both domestic and international, who have relied on those decisions. And whether Mr. Netanyahu's rise and Mr. Trump's wins also remains to be seen, because as Noam Chomsky and various others have pointed out, historically, the state of Israel is the junior ally in the American empire. And without the American imperial backing, you may not have the empowered little, David state taking on the live world. So how Mr. Trump plays out, and it's, of course, based on clearly what his advisors tell him. So how Stephen Miller suggests he proceed, how Elon Musk suggests he proceed, how various other factors play a role, including how Republicans facing midterm elections at the end of the year may face an electoral challenge if they can't be voted back in. But Mr. Trump is also known for having said last year that this might be the last time Americans get to vote. So market investors will never have to vote again.
Having said all of this, there's also the nuance that he is shifting the global politics in the sense that the very right-wing extremists are feeling a bit more emboldened around the world. I don't know if those are your sentiments, but we are starting to see a rise in that kind of, bold rhetoric of very right-wing kind of voices. Yes, I think we'll speak to about South Africa just now, but do you agree that his presidency has certainly emboldened some of those really extremist right-wing movements around the world?
We know that his first term emboldened various leaders, including President Bolsonaro of Brazil, and now the new presidency in the 2025 period seems to embolden people who didn't elect in places like Argentina, like Mele, to begin to imagine that you no longer need those cumbersome processes of democracy to proceed. And there will be various groups around the world who have very anti-democratic thoughts about how their societies could be run more efficiently, who may be finding this quite useful. So we've already seen the influence of Elon Musk going into Europe and making statements in places like Germany, speaking to people like Prime Minister Meloni in Italy in ways that even she found a little bit awkward, about how it is possible to rethink the democratic experiment and to move beyond democracy. So there will also be actors across the world who look to this moment and see Trumpism as a new form of doing politics, which is shock and awe, just make pronouncements, just go ahead and do these things and see where the chips fall and see what you can get away with.
So with that kind of, I'm going to call it noise, of President Trump, what does that mean for China? I would imagine that it gives them a really interesting position in the world now. They are, I don't know, I feel like they can emerge as more powerful.
It is possible that there's a new multipolar world emerging. In order for us to think in those terms, we might have to imagine that this isn't just some kind of internal dynamic in the American state, that this is the beginning of the final step of the decline of the American empire. So as Mr. Trump increasingly becomes quite, shall we say, isolationist in the United States, withdrawing it from the World Health Organization, withdrawing it from the Paris Climate Accords, which he had done before. We may begin to see a return to very late 19th century United States politics, what they used to call the Monroe Doctrine, which under President Monroe was about the American state having its influence mostly in the Western Hemisphere, in the two Americas, North and South America, in the Pacific and Atlantic immediately neighboring on it. And we hear this when Mr. Trump says things like, we're going to just make Canada the 52nd state or whatever it is. We're just going to take over Greenland. We have our designs on the Panama Canal. And this seems to be the noise, as you put it, in the background, while the local American state, which has enabled social welfare, taxation of the rich, is all being actively dismantled. There may be pushback in the state, but if the pushback is not quick enough and strategic enough, what you sit with is the result of the dismantling. Whether that isolation then emboldens China, and whether then previous client states have to engage with the Chinese state very differently, remains to be seen. China, of course, remains a major force in manufacturing and export. And, the sort of sanctions that Mr. Trump puts on China has very specific domestic American economic consequences. And if they remain in place, then what you're likely to sit with is a decline of the American economy. It still is the most powerful economy in the world. But should Mr. Trump continue in this direction, that may, no longer be the case. The European Union and several NATO partners of the United States in Western Europe may, of course, have to strengthen their ties with China and take a different route when it comes to international diplomacy and international trade. So we've already seen Mr. Trump climb down from the trade wars that he initiated with Canada and with Mexico. One imagines that at some point, when he suggests that these tariffs will just be slapped on Chinese imports, the local American domestic market will begin to be affected, and he may have to climb down from that as well.
So,
and partly it is governance by ignorance by many of his advisors. So we'd like to see what happens with China's response to this.
That was going to be my next question, because I was going to ask you if that's all logical to, I think, any sensible person, that this is going to be counterproductive. But maybe I'm wrong, and I wanted to ask you, what do you think his end game is here? Do you think he didn't see that, or he's not thinking about that scenario? What do you think is actually happening in his head?
So I don't think it's just Mr. Trump and what's happening in his head that is responsible for this. I think there is a class of people in the United States who enable the election of Mr. Trump. And it's a class of very wealthy Americans, billionaires. Often it is seen as just immigrant billionaires, but it's not just immigrant billionaires. They're people who've been in the United States since the 19th century, families, inherited wealth, elite. Who see in Mr. Trump an opportunity to undo all of the taxation and Thomas Duclos, who the French economist describes as quite well, that was put in place the taxation, the regulations about inheriting, paying tax, since at least 1913, a date that has a very different meaning for us in South Africa,
yeah.
where the opposite was happening. So dispossession was happening quite actively in South Africa, but in the United States, there was a repossession of wealth. So inheritance tax was at its highest, sometimes as high as 70 to 80%. Capital gains tax was put in place because the Gilded Age of the late 19th century, that many people will have some familiarity with from watching a television series about that period, was about high concentration of wealth and mass poverty. Many of the public institutions of the United States that were built over that century were very resentfully funded by American wealthy families as part of their philanthropy. What Mr. Trump is allowing that class of people to do is to dismantle the state structure that has taxed them so highly and allowed greater concentrations of wealth to be possible. So we've seen billionaires have become even wealthier since November the 21st when he was elected, and has started to become even more wealthy since he took office, since January 21. So the calculation is something like Mr. Musk alone makes $800 million a day. He's now promised a $400 billion dollar contract to provide Tesla Cybertrucks to the American State Department. So my sense is that this is a sudden reorganization of the United States as an oligarchy.
Gotcha.
That ironically mirrors very much what happened in Russia in the wake of the Soviet Union, where there is mass concentration of wealth in very small numbers of people who have very specific relations of exploitation with the state and stay close to the leader. And how Mr. Putin has been able to stay in power. So while people have thought that Mr. Trump is a client of Mr. Putin, my sense is that the American oligarchs are suddenly turning the United States into the same structure that you have in Russia, which is that the wealthy own the state, and they make as much as they possibly can off the state and pay no tax into the state.
Where does that leave that conversation that's been happening around Ukraine and Russia? There's a lot of movement right now, lots of preparation for negotiations. What do you think is going to be the outcome of these negotiations?
Well, I think it's symbolic that the proposal is that these negotiations happen in Saudi Arabia, which is at the center of, precious minerals exploration and fossil fuel industry. Because, again, they're scaling back in the United States of environmental protections, of federal agencies' ability to oversee, to protect consumers. Is very much about getting those people who are, fossil fuel industry billionaires to make even more money, unregulated and uncontrolled. And so the two major negotiators, the United States and Russia, are producers of and profiteers. And I don't mean the government, I mean the billionaires who aren't in control of it, those administrations by political funding or by outright ownership. And so the idea is that Ukraine might find itself in the crosshairs precisely because it is going to be likely to be sacrificed in the interest of settling a deal between Russia and the United States. And we know that historically those kinds of deals leave the territory that's being negotiated over, at risk. So what's happening with the settlement in Gaza is likely to happen to Ukrainians. We've already heard the various figures in the Trump administration have said the Ukrainians will just have to settle this by giving land back to Russia.
Wow.
And then making alternative statements the week after. We've now heard from several NATO partners, including Keir Starmer, who is seen to be a US ally, as the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, suggesting that he's willing to put British soldiers on the ground in Ukraine should that be needed.
Yeah.
Which takes you all the way back to the Crimean War of the 19th century. This is what used to be, a proxy war, might become a hot Third World War when NATO partners put their soldiers on the ground and not, in material practice, but in actual political practice, because we know that there have been Western European involvement and NATO involvement and support in Ukraine. It's very different when there are actual UK citizens and soldiers fighting in the war against Russia. That will be an interesting realignment, particularly given Mr. Trump's own relationship with NATO, which is often quite counterfactual and quite difficult. So we may be seeing a new world order emerging, and it may be the decline of the American empire, but it's likely to be messy, with ripple effects and consequences across the world, even for those of us who sit on distant shores like in South Africa.
Let's come back to South Africa now and how South Africa should be reacting to all that's happening right now. Of course, I think, I get the sense that we're scrambling a bit. The president has announced that he's going to be sending various envoys to different parts of the world to explain our policies. That's how they're framing it. How do you think we should be reacting to what's happening?
Well, you know, the South African government is in a difficult position because it's not had a clearly articulated foreign policy position that was coherent on a variety of issues. And it had sort of been waiting, many of us observed, to see how the world order settles itself and then pick the winning side. So it had not backed anyone outrightly. It had gone to the position of choosing when and how to create allies. So it continued within the BRICS system to work with China and Russia, and that's not necessarily always been the same position. Russia and China have had different positions on different things. Two of our BRICS partners are technically still in a relationship with one another. That's China and India. So our foreign policy within BRICS is also not clearly articulated, because BRICS has some conflicting articulations, desires, and needs. And then in front of the United Nations, we've been carrying the African Union position that Africa needs to have prominence in the Security Council. But if the United Nations is increasingly a toothless organization, because one, the headquarters is in the United States, two, the U.S. is a major funder of it, three, the U.S. has increasingly over the last 30 years bucked any suggestion that the United Nations has the ability to police its actions on the global frame, and this, you know, was most visible during the invasion of Iraq, and the UN position on what it was doing in Guantanamo, in the wake of the invasion of Iraq. So my sense is that this is a difficult place for the government of South Africa to be. The people of South Africa, of course, a variety of responses, because in the wake of 1994 and our independence from the internalized colonialism that was the apartheid, and I attempt to move beyond that kind of humanity, the idea that we're building one nation hasn't really taken off. So there are different people in this state who have very, in this country, who have very different ideas about how they want to relate to the world. And I don't mean as individuals, I mean even as organizations. We have a very relationship with the state of Israel than was the official position of the Republic of South Africa National Forum and in multilateral and in bilateral relations with Israel. Okay. How they now sit inside the government of national coalition with their beliefs about what the state of Israel should be and could be doing, and where it's doing, very different. And the same with the United States. We've had the Democratic Alliance, made by the official opposition, ticked the United States a particular set of agenda items to discuss. And now we have AfriForum, which is not an inside government, but is a major player in the public domain in South Africa, partly because the media give them attention, even though they may not have any kind of representation, any sense whatsoever, who have vacillated on what it is they're doing. And now there is another group that has indicated they've marched on the embassy to deliver a petition. When we spoke earlier about groups that are trying to exploit this moment in American history, here you have people who see Mr. Trump as their chance. They saw him as their chance in 2016 through the QAnon conspiracy, through the localization of Trump politics, to get what they thought they need and are entitled to in the South African space by extra democratic, sometimes even extra judicial means. So if you can't get it by getting elected, and if you can't get it by going through the court system, one imagines these are now people who are emboldened to believe Kerry is a strong man who says things in his political space that we want to implement in the local political space. And so ordinary South Africans have to think about how to, one, strengthen the way in business, strengthen how we build a country in which we all feel we belong. Getting people who feel they don't belong to realize that there are ways of belonging in South Africa, that they would have been alienated from, not just by what has happened over the last 30 years, but by myth-making about what has happened before 1994. And then secondarily, reminding our government that their primary focus should also be about making sure the local is stable enough, that local forces can't exploit these divisions and take us down a path of great undemocratic processes. Because the last thing we want is to have to deal with all of our problems that we already have, and people emboldened by what is happening in Washington to create insurrection, instability, unhappiness here. We have enough problems as it is. Those of us who live in Johannesburg wake up to no power, no water from day to day. That's not going to be an issue that a war or any kind of conflict with the United States is likely to resolve. And it will distract us and take resources we need to actually build our society from, one, the errors of the past 30 years and the inequalities actively created by apartheid and colonialism before that. And it would be a tragic betrayal of the chance we have given ourselves in 1994 to get us distracted into and sucked into the global conflagration that we can quite easily remain apart from.
And I mean, I suppose intellectually we knew that there were pockets of these people who have these extreme views about where we are and who we are. But I suppose seeing it, you know, in real time was quite something, especially those who are wearing the old flag. Your sense of how we should react to that as society?
Again, you know, it is possible to convince, I think, often younger people, that the stories they're being told about the past and about the possibility of making a future that may not be what their parents are telling them or even their grandparents' generation. But there, I think, again, the failure has been that of ANC government after ANC government in 1994. There was much more focused on its own myth-making rather than on actually constructing a state with a functioning education system that would deliver critically literate education. So what we've seen is, you know, South Africa's decline of literacy over the last 12 to 15 years. And I've said this before, but many people will look back at this moment and realize that that screwing up of the education system, making it such that 80% of 10-year-olds can't read from any language, that that was not an accident, that that is what helped keep the people in power in power. Because as the Palestinian professor Edward Said, who worked in the United States, once wrote in Al-Ahram Weekly in Egypt, you know, if people are not literate, they are at the mercy of powerful players who can exploit their ignorance and their inability to understand issues, and they can use them for their own ends. And he was writing this about the tragedy of literacy and illiteracy in the Middle East and comparing it to the increasing tragedy of literacy and illiteracy he was seeing among graduate students in Columbia, the University of Columbia in New York. And so in South Africa, when we look at, when we hear these stories of 80% of 10-year-olds who are tested couldn't read the meaning in any language, but we see other political consequences of that. And we've seen that with local ethno-nationalist, right-wing, highly ethnicist parties exploiting people's unhappiness with the bigger party, and some of the bigger parties swinging themselves rightwards to try and call upon those constituents. And you can only do that in a state in which people are not able to see through the magic show and realize what the trickery is. And that, of course, ties in with what the sixth administration in Parliament has also suggested about the way in which information is distributed in this society. So the Communication Portfolio Committee suggested from the get-go that they want South Africa to have the same kinds of protections for the people who live here on platforms like Meta and X and others that EU citizens have. So disallowing for disinformation, making sure that the people who own these platforms take some responsibility for what is said there, because we know that there is a great trust deficit in South Africa already in institutions, including mainstream news media,
mm-hmm.
and people are consuming their information about the world in other forms.
Mm-hmm.
So those forms remain unregulated, and this is one of the protections the EU is known for. It means that people can be given information that interferes with their ability to make rational and truly informed decisions when it comes to politics or the making of everyday life.
Yeah, but
to a large extent, we've seen that in the United States, mm-hmm. not yet so much in South Africa, but we're beginning to see that when people, you know, the July 21 riots come to mind.
Yeah, but we would have to reckon with what you've just said. You know, not just one element of trying to correct what's going on. It's everything. We'd have to look at the education system and how we've responded to what's required and why we're here. Quickly, my last question is about the Expropriation Act and obviously Donald Trump's response to that. Surely it's not about that. What is it about and who's whispering in his ears?
Again, it's part of Mr. Trump's shock and awe. So there will be people inside the Trump administration
mm-hmm.
who have their own designs on, you know, local minerals or mm-hmm. local resources that they wish to have access to. And it's easier to negotiate that with a state in chaos or a state mm-hmm. that is disabled or a state that's run by other oligarchs like you,
mm-hmm.
If that is what your design is. And it's also a distraction from very specific local issues in the United States. So there will be groups in South Africa and groups in the United States seeing this as a moment to talk to one another around white nationalist agendas. And we've suddenly seen this in the first Trump administration when he supported the Proud Boys and said that there are some good people there. His refusal to come out and speak against January 6th assault on the Capitol in Washington, D.C.
Mm.
These are moments in which Mr. Trump exploits these people's anxieties and fears. My sense is that there are people inside the Trump circle who want to exploit the fears of Afrikaners, and we've now suddenly seen what their vision is for that, which is to replace brown immigrants with white immigrants. When somebody asks, well, what happens to these white Afrikaners who now arrive in the U.S. and have land, not dollars, and can't just buy property, one of the senators responded on the X platform in an official capacity, though you know, obviously not speaking technical policy, and said, well, you'll become workers on the farm until you get enough cash together to buy your own land. Which, again, sounds like the promise made to very many immigrants in the 19th century by other famous empires. Let's not forget that prior to the First World War, the British Empire was indeed very powerful. And by the end of the First World War, we saw the beginning of the collapse of the British Empire. So within 14 years, by the start of the First World War, the Second World War, the British Empire had all but disappeared, and by the end of the war was gone and had to be reinvented as the Commonwealth. So what I think the United States is undergoing is an internal crisis of overreaching its imperial arm, and like many empires that overreach, the collapse can be quite swift. And if you also have bad management of the empire center, then if you look at the Roman Empire, it collapsed soon quickly. The Aztec Empire collapsed very quickly. Empires are deeply unstable, and those who rule them tend to overreach and tend to have megalomaniac dreams because the world is not necessarily going to play along with this. If you think of the German Empire established in 1933, by 1945 it was gone.
Angela Fick, what a pleasure. I really appreciate your take there. Thank you very much for giving us your time this evening.
Thank you.
Angela Fick is director at research at a Social Economic Research Institute.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.